Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Music and Spinner.com, where you can get free MP3s, exclusive interviews, and more. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 246 for May 3rd, 2010. 2.5 journalists. This Week in Tech is brought to you by GoToTraining. Improve learning, participation, and access to training programs, and save a bunch with GoToTraining. For a free trial, visit GoToTraining.com. And by Audible.com. To download two free audiobooks of your choice, go to audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter at audible_com. And by squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com/twit. It's time for TWiT, This Week in Tech, the show that covers all the tech news, and joining us some actual real-life tech journalists. I'm merely a pundit, but you can't say that about Mr. Dwight Silverman. He is tech reporter for the Houston Chronicle, the venerable Houston Chronicle, blogs at blogs.cron.com/techblog. Welcome, Dwight.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I don't get to be a pundit.
Oh, well, what is there? Can you be both?
I think you can. I always have a piece of paper that says, actually, my journalism degree from the University of Houston says Bachelor of Journalism, which gives me a BJ. I'm always proud of that.
Wait a minute. I'm changing your lower third. Dwight Silverman, BJ. Very good. Congratulations. That's a promotion.
Yeah, I think so.
They probably call it a JB.
No, they do not.
They call it a BJ.
They do call it a BJ.
That's what she said. All right, joining us also, he's in the dark, but not because he's at the Witness Protection Program, but merely because Veronica Belmont's in Japan, Mr. Ryan Block of Gadget, GDGT.com. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, thanks for having me. I want to lay claim to being the most backlit guest that you ever had.
I swear to God, all we have to do is make your voice so dark, dersh, people would think we had Steve Jobs on or something. I don't know.
Exactly.
And always,
do you have a vocoder?
I can make you sound funny.
All right, let's do it.
We could do that probably after the fact. I don't know if I could do it. I don't know. I'll have to. This board does many things, most of which I don't understand. Also with us, Mr. Mark Millian of the Los Angeles Times. Hey, Mark.
Hey, I am actually front lit in front of a bright, sunny window.
You look fantastic, Mark.
Why, thank you, Leo.
Your beat is new media / social media, kind of?
Social media, general internet type stuff, but I do cover a little bit of Apple and helped out with the Palm HP thing last week.
Well, that's the big story of the week, obviously. But, you know, it's funny because if I'd had Ryan on, he probably would have known this last Sunday, and I should have had you on. But we missed the big story of the week last TWiT because it happened, even though it happened Friday, a week ago Friday, nobody knew about it till Monday, and that, of course, is the raid at Jason Chen's house. This is back to the lost iPhone, and no, we're not going to spend an hour talking about the lost iPhone on this, but I thought since we hadn't talked about it on TWiT because we didn't know about it, and because we got such an august panel, I think it'd be good to talk about it today. First of all, Ryan, you know, you found it in Gadget. You're well aware of the Gadget blog wars. What do you know about this? Do you think Gadget was offered the phone and turned it down, and then Gizmodo took it? What is your take on this all?
Well, you know, Engadget was offered the phone at the same time or right around when Gizmodo was offered it.
They had a picture.
And that's how Engadget had the photos up first. The difference was Engadget passed on it, so they had these photos from the people shopping it around, but they didn't have the phone itself. So, Engadget didn't know whether or not it was real. They suspected that it was, but it was hard to say because Gizmodo actually had the device by that point. Engadget had photos. So it was a little bit different. But, you know, Engadget, we sold it to AOL in 2005. AOL is obviously a very large publicly traded company. So from a legal standpoint, they're, you know, fairly cautious. I think that from, and I don't even want to get into like the ethical moral discussion. I mean, I think that you probably have already hashed that out quite a bit.
Yeah, but I point people to MacBreak Weekly, This Week in Law, This Week in Google, all of the shows of the past week.
Yeah.
We've probably done five hours on this subject.
I don't think we need to get into the moral or ethical aspects of that. But, you know, for whatever reason, they chose to pass on it, more than likely due to, you know, advice from legal counsel, AOL Legal, and you know, it tends to be very conservative in terms of, you know, liability. Since it's a very large company, they want to limit as much liability as they can. And Gizmodo did not pass on it.
Were you offered the phone?
No, I was not offered the phone.
Would you have bought it had you been offered the phone?
You know, I wouldn't have bought it, but I probably would have tried like hell to figure out a way to do it in a way that was not illegal. Because, you know, when you acquire the phone, that's when it becomes illegal.
It's purchasing stolen property.
Selling the phone, that is also legal.
Right.
If you would have just said, hey, I'd love to come over to your house for a couple of days and maybe rent a room. And if there should happen to be a phone on the table, then that would be great. No, I don't know. You know, I mean,
I'll have to remember that next time. I would like to rent a room in your home for $5,000. And if there should happen to be a phone there, I wouldn't be terrible.
Right, exactly. I mean, like, it's easy to kind of say what you might have done or what you might not have done. I mean, it's hard.
It's hard. Somebody asked me that. If somebody had shown up at the door of the Twit Cottage saying, I think this is the next iPhone, I would like you to have it. I wouldn't have paid $5,000, but only because I didn't have $5,000. If he'd say, would you give me $5, I would give him $5. And it's just as illegal.
Well, that would be illegal.
Yeah, not a felony unless it's 900 plus, but yeah, isn't that interesting?
Mean, you know.
What do you think? I mean, let me ask Dwight, because presumably, you know, you work for a newspaper. This kind of thing comes up. The Houston Chronicle won't pay for a scoop like this, would it?
No, I don't think we would have paid for that. And particularly, you know, at the time that they were offered the phone, they didn't know that it wasn't a Chinese knockoff. It might not necessarily have been a real iPhone. Do you want to shell out that kind of money on the possibility that it's not real or that it was gotten illegally? You know, I would have turned it down flat, but like Ryan said, I would have been at my most persuasive trying to at least get my hands on it.
How about you,
Mark?
You
know, it's your kind of obligation, Ryan, as a journalist to figure out, is this real? If it's real, how much can I learn about this without, right, you know, without myself breaking the law, right? So there's this dance that you have to play in these situations, which, you know, you want to do the right thing, but you also have an obligation to your audience to break the story. I mean, if you're not doing that, you're not doing your job. So you want to make sure that you can do your job, but also not be breaking the law.
It's tricky. I understand that line, and you're walking that line. That's why we do meta news here.
I'm not walking that line.
Yeah, me neither. I do meta news. I only cover what you covered. And then you take the fall, but I get to talk about the Gizmodo story for weeks without any risk at all. Mark, what would the LA Times do? Did they give you any schooling? I mean, you came out of college to the Times. Did they sit you down with a lawyer at some point and say, here's the rules?
Yeah, you know, I talked to one of the editors at Gizmodo right after it went down, and he told me first, I believe, I was the first to report that they had actually paid something for the phone. He confirmed that, yeah, we did pay for it, which was kind of obvious. But Wired was also offered the phone in addition to Engadget. But Gizmodo ended up paying, Gawker ended up paying $5,000 for it. And they didn't come to the LA Times. Would the LA Times have paid for it? It's a little shady, but we have paid for things in the past. I mean, even something as simple as if we're reviewing the iPad, we're going to buy an iPad and pay for that unit to review it.
Well, that's what I do too, because I don't want to owe Apple anything. I prefer to buy it. I can afford to buy it, so maybe it's better to buy it.
There was also a circumstance a few years ago of the LA Times paying for what appeared to be a stolen flash drive that was being sold on the black market in Afghanistan.
That's a good analogy
of the U.S. military.
So there's a perfect analogy. There's a public's right to know. The provenance of this thing is unknown, so you could be culpable. Yet it's your job to expose this information. What did the Times do?
Well, there's still a bit of a difference between the U.S. military and Apple's, like, shady trade secrets.
Yeah, who wants – which one would you prefer to cross? Steve Jobs or the Joint Chiefs of Staff? I'd prefer to cross the Joint Chiefs.
Yeah.
They may have nukes, but Jobs got a bad temper.
Well, so with this memory card, it was this Afghani black market, and it was actually U.S. military secrets that were on this memory stick. So it's the LA Times did end up paying for it.
Really?
It's kind of a good thing they did, so that it didn't get in the hands of some terrorist organization.
That's why Gizmodo bought the phone. They didn't want it to get in the hands of the terrorists.
They didn't want to see it get into the wrong terrorists.
I'm surprised, actually, that Nick Denton didn't use that excuse. I think he used every other excuse. If he'd only thought of that one.
You know, he's pulling out journalism, like roles and shield laws, and
right.
And I ended up digging up this quote, Denton talking to the Washington Post. I think it was a couple of years ago, and saying that it's not the institutional intent to be journalists.
Right.
We may commit journalism at times
by accident.
Yeah,
Denton's been pretty out about their intentions for a very long time. I mean, they've never viewed themselves as Gawker as an organization has never really viewed themselves as an above board kind of journalistic operation. And there are people there who I think take their job seriously and who do think of themselves as journalists. But Denton, I think that is totally a sincere comment from him. I mean, it's not his intention to commit journalism on a daily basis. He's out for page views. He's out for money. And the funny thing is about the situation. I mean, it might have been largely avoided if he hadn't been, so aggressive about tub thumping the fact that they paid money for this phone. I mean, if they'd never really talked about it, there's a good chance this all just would have gone away.
Right.
They'd have made the story about the phone and not about how they got the phone.
Well, that's where the stink is, you know, the way that they outed this guy, the way that they published his picture. I mean, the whole thing, that kind of stinks. I was not pleased about that.
Well,
that's Nick Gizmodo. It's 100%
yep.
him.
Yeah,
Gawker and Gizmodo want to have it both ways. You know, they want to be known as kind of an outlaw organization in terms of news. They don't necessarily want people to think of them as journalists. But then, that's how else do you build your credibility? You know, you have a reputation, and you build that by reporting that's true and reporting that is believable and reporting to a certain extent that's fair.
But they got millions of page views.
Millions of page views.
This was very valuable.
This is the, you know, this is the dilemma of the web, I think. I think every news organization that has the ability to see how many people are looking at their news and what they're looking at, you know, as soon as you see what people are looking at, that changes what you write about. And I think that just because you can count something doesn't mean it's a good idea that you should.
Can you speak
to the Gizmodo case?
Ryan, can you speak to the competition between Gizmodo and Engadget? It seems like it's worse than the Journal and the Times. It's worse than any competition, worse than the, you know, Giants Dodgers. I mean, they would do anything to beat Gizmodo would do anything to beat Engadget to the punch.
I don't know if it's really about that anymore. I think actually the competition has largely kind of died down.
There were
a few. I mean, look, they're both the two most prominent gadget technology publications in the business. So of course they're competing with each other on a day to day basis.
But they've kind of made it so they don't have to.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. You know, back in the day when we first started Engadget, you know, it was our only job to catch up to Gizmodo. And we did that in about 9 months, which we were all kind of shocked by.
Right.
And then at that point, our job was to legitimize the publication because, you know, you got to remember back in 2004, 2005, you know, gadget blogs, it wasn't a thing. You know, it wasn't the way that it is today. I mean, most publications gave preference to most organizations gave preference to publications with some kind of print. You know, a magazine or a newspaper. Now it's really shifted. You know, online is the focus, and print and magazines and newspapers are you know of increasingly less importance. No offense, Mark. At this point, kind of the fact is, both publications have earned their place at the table, so to speak. You know, they've earned their place in the pantheon, and so the competition is not as heated as it once was, because at the time it was competing with each other and competing to prove that they could actually make legitimate publications. Now it's kind of been shown.
Yeah, everybody knows that. Yeah.
Nobody questions the fact that Engadget and Gizmodo are legitimate publications now.
So what's the latest? The last I heard was that the San Mateo police decided to hold off on their investigation pending a ruling on the Shield laws, because there's some question whether their search warrant was legal given California and federal protection laws. And until they get a ruling for sure, they're not going to look at Jason's stuff. Meanwhile, Jason doesn't have a computer, doesn't have an iPad, doesn't have business cards, because they took those too. And he's just kind of floating in space, poor guy. Is there an update to Dwight on that story? I mean, we're just in hold right now.
Yes, the last I've seen is that they simply are sitting on it. I'm not sure who they're asking. I guess it would maybe be California Attorney General, or maybe just the DA. But at this point, it's the investigation is in limbo, and I imagine that somebody at Gizmodo can loan Jason maybe an old HP notebook.
Something. Well, this has made his career in some ways. If he doesn't go to jail, it's good. This is a good thing. If he goes to jail, it's not so good. Do you think it's Jason that's they're investigating? Who are they investigating?
I think he obviously is at the root, because he's in the video holding the phone. He's the guy going, "This is the phone."
That actually doesn't necessarily mean anything.
No, but
in terms of the criminal prosecution, if they take this to court, they're not looking. They don't care who's showing the phone.
They're trying to figure out who bought it.
The reason they went to his house is either they're looking for evidence. The chances are that most of the evidence that they need is the root of it is going to be at Jason's house. Right. That's why they went to his
house. And that's what they said. They said, no, he's not a suspect. We're just investigating.
Right. They're looking for evidence.
I'd hate to be that kind of suspect, Mark Millian. Oh, let's take all your crap. We're just investigating.
Right. Well, at my publication, we get a little bit more protection, and I'm willing to bet we have a lot more lawyers.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, you just because you're an actual newspaper,
we wouldn't let the police in the building. They wouldn't be able to break into our office and just lift my computer off of their desk and walk out. Jason was working out of his home.
Right. Interesting because the chief counsel, the COO at Gawker, had given him an email saying, show this to the cops when they come, that says California Shield laws prohibit you from searching this premise. And the cop said, oh, that's interesting. I'll keep that. We'll have that also as part of the evidence. Thank you. What else you got? Because they'd been there for 2 hours when he came home.
Well, the question, the debate is, do California Shield laws shield journalists from situations where they may have committed a felony? And that's the question here. There's the investigation is not to find out who supplied them with the phone and who committed that act. The investigation is about the felony or supposed felony act of purchasing stolen merchandise.
Somebody's pointing out that this is like 3 years ago internet time. It happened. We found out about it on Monday, and it does feel like old news. So we're going to wrap it up. But it's a fascinating story. We've talked to a number of lawyers. We had Denise Howell on MacBreak Weekly. It was MacBreak Weekly. We've had, there's the EFF has weighed in. The New York Times has talked to lawyers. And there doesn't seem to be agreement about exactly what's going on or who exactly, is protected by Shield rules. According to somebody in our chat room, I don't know, I'd like to find the source of this. The police think they found the culprit and he's regretful about it. The guy who actually stole the phone. This is a Mashable story.
Yeah, his name has come out. The guy
right,
who
Wired
found
outed
it.
Him.
I'm really surprised that it took this long. I mean, he shopped this to pretty much every technology publication out there. Engadget, Gizmodo, Wired, CNET.
Can I say his name? I guess I can say his name. 21-year-old Brian Hogan of Redwood City. Wired uncovered his identity after following a trail of clues on social media websites, some of which have now been taken down. He has an attorney, Jeffrey Bornstein, who provided a statement to Wired stating, quote, Hogan regrets his mistake in not doing more to return the phone. Apparently, he had a friend try to contact AppleCare to return the phone.
Yeah, that's not the best way.
To huh? You know, of course,
we tech support. What more could he do?
You guys missing a phone? Anyway, he's got a lawyer, and I think if I were him, I'd have a lawyer too. And if there is a criminal investigation, clearly it's going to center around whoever they think got the phone originally. Interesting that the guy at Apple, as far as we know, still has not been fired. The original engineer, we won't say his name. I think he should be somewhat protected until he's, you know, there's some evidence that he's culpable of a crime.
You know, it doesn't matter.
When they
though,
do that, the that, announcement that of the next iPhone, they ought to have him on the stage showing the new version of great. Find My iPhone.
And one more thing, Mr. Gray, here's right. the phone.
Yeah, that's
no, you know, nice. In that story, the Wired story, one of the funny things is towards the end of it, the attorney is trying to paint a picture of Hogan as a guy who's never been in trouble before, and actually pulls out the line that he works with Chinese orphans.
Oh, that's nice.
Isn't that nice?
That's sweet. He obviously must have known what he saw there. It's a great story. I'm sure there'll be more. We will probably talk more about it. But as we hadn't covered it on Twit, there you go. There's the latest. It'd be easy to find out what's going on with that. And I did want to ask these three esteemed panelists what they thought about it. This has been a week for acquisitions. HP buys Palm, Apple buys Siri. There's more. We will talk about that in just a little bit, but we're going to take a break right now. Dwight Silverman is with us from the Houston Chronicle, Mark Millian from the LA Times, and from GDGT.com, our good friend Ryan Block. This is Twit. Before I go much further, I want to tell you about something brand new from the folks at Citrix. It's called GoToTraining. Wow, this is a great idea. You know, they do that Go to My PC, the remote access program. They do Go to Meeting, which is great for business. Go to Training takes that backbone, the great computer sharing backbone that Citrix is known for, remote access, and applies it to training. And I'll tell you, this is something we've needed for a long time. If you've had to sit through a boring seminar at work, or you've tried some of the online training solutions, you're going to love Go to Training. What an improvement. Go to Training. You can have up to 200 people in your training. You can have your presenters be anywhere in the world. 200 live, but then you can record the training. So then this is beautiful. So that after the training's done, you've got an on-demand version of it. There's a training content library to which you can upload any document type or link to any website so your trainees can review it before, during, and after the training. Of course, completely customizable training tests, polls, integrated chat. It is just a fantastic platform. I want you to try it free for 30 days. If you're a trainer, this is something you need to know about. Go to training.com. 1 month absolutely free. If you're not a trainer, but you had to put up with bad training, which I just had to do, I'm not even going to talk about it. That's why I'm a big fan of this. You really ought to tell your trainer about go to training.com. 30 days free from the folks at Citrix. GOTOtraining.com. Please. Tell your IT department about this. You don't want to have to suffer any longer. Enough with the suffering. So I think this is a great story and really deserved to be the lead story. I wanted to get the iPhone story out of the way, but really the big story today is HP buying Palm for $1.2 billion. Did any of you see that coming? Mark Millian, did you see that coming?
I did not, but since it happens, it makes sense.
Makes sense. It's like it's one of those, oh, I should have thought of that. How about you, Ryan? Did you think that was going to happen?
Not necessarily HP, but somebody was definitely.
I mean, really?
They made it clear that they were going to sell.
We knew they were for sale. HTC passed. Lenovo was kind of considered. But I don't think I would have thought of HP. Now, HP, $1.2 billion is not a whole lot for HP. And boy, it puts them back in the game.
Yeah, it does. And I think that the one thing Apple has kind of proven, especially if you look at their quarterly results over the last year and how much of their revenue is now represented by iPhone specifically, is that you need to have some skin in this game. Like, you have to be in the mobile space now because the opportunity is just so massive. And for HP to be able to snap up kind of a premium smartphone company with its own operating system, with its own intellectual property, it's a pretty good move for them. The question is whether they're going to screw it up.
As they've known to. Dwight, do you think it's for the iPhone or do you think the HP slate will run not Windows 7 but WebOS?
Well, I think they said during the announcement and in the conference call afterwards that They are looking at it for tablets. Ryan had mentioned in a tweet that the WebOS is an embedded OS and wouldn't necessarily work in its current form on the Slate. But the WebOS is built around Linux, and so it should be relatively easy to port it over if they haven't already. I'm sure somebody at Palm had been playing around with the idea of tablets. And I think primarily that's why HP bought it. Yeah, I think you need to be in the mobile market, but I don't necessarily know that mobile means smartphone. And HP, in its acquisition of Compaq, got a really nice notebook design group, which is based here in Houston. All of their HP notebooks are designed here, and I believe the Slate was designed here as well. And so those guys are probably just drooling to get their hands on this thing and put it to work.
Well, let's not forget that they're, believe it or not, I was shocked to learn this, HP does sell a smartphone. It's an iPac, the brand it got from Compaq.
Right.
Running that, Windows Mobile.
And what's interesting is it's a very much early 2000s design.
Oh, yeah. It's clunky as hell.
It's very clunky. In fact, it looks like the old Palm. It looks like the old... the big fat Palm smartphone. So, they've said that they're going to keep those around, at least initially, but my suspicion is that, they won't last much longer. Interestingly, also in that conference call, they made a lot of soothing sounds to Microsoft and continue to say, oh, Microsoft is a great partner. So,
well, of course they're going to smooth those feathers.
Right, right. But I suspect at Microsoft, you know, particularly since Steve Ballmer was on the stage at CES showing off his Slate computer running Windows 7, and now with the rumor that the Slate computer running Windows 7 is dead, I imagine that Steve Ballmer is not happy.
Oopsies. Yeah, this was a TechCrunch rumor, and I don't know whether to credit or not. Mike Arrington says the Slate is dead. So let's talk. Actually, Ryan, let me ask you, why do you say the WebOS wouldn't work on the Slate?
Well, I mean, they could design a tablet to run WebOS. That's fine. It's just WebOS as an embedded operating system doesn't run on the kind of processors that the Slate has.
It's for an ARM. It's for an ARM processor.
Yeah, it's for an embedded ARM processor.
Yeah,
it's the it's like iPhone OS runs on the iPad and on the iPhone and on the iPod Touch. Those all run the same processors. You can't run desktop OS 10 on that.
Right.
It's just you can't do it. I mean, there are ports and. You could try, but that's not really the point. The point is that these are very particular types of processors intended for, you know, low power consumption and high performance with very particular kinds of operations.
So really it would be just a redesigned Slate. I mean, we saw the Slate specs leaked out. It was an Atom processor. Well, it couldn't be an Atom processor for WebOS.
I mean, the problem with the Slate is we saw all the specs, and I mean, they were really just going after the tablet PC, the Slate PC design.
It was very generic.
It's been around for many years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a new thing. You know, there have been NECs and Toshibas. There have been all kinds of Slate PCs been around for you know, the last 8, 9 years.
They've been crappy, frankly.
Yeah, and they've been terrible. I mean, you look at this thing, it's got USB ports, it's got all these ports. I mean, it's a very small Slate style PC. That's not what you want. You don't really want, I mean, okay, maybe you do want that.
It's not what I want.
I want something that's a little bit more like the iPad where it's very optimized.
You don't want a netbook without a keyboard.
Exactly. But if I wanted that, I would just get a netbook.
Yeah.
Right? If I wanted something along those lines, if I wanted a
free
PC,
keyboard with every Slate.
I would get it with the keyboard.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what they're offering, what they had on offer was a PC without a keyboard. So what they need to do is they really need to rethink the Slate and you know, think about it in terms of, not in terms of the desktop OS metaphor, because that thing was going to run Windows 7.
Right.
They need to rethink it and, you know, think about how WebOS would be applied to a Slate style, portable device.
Mark Millian?
I don't know. Are ports so bad? I've heard from a lot of people whose biggest problem with the iPad is that they have to buy an external dongle to plug in a camera and a separate adapter, which doesn't yet exist, to print. And I mean, this it could be the best of both worlds. I agree with Dwight that Palm OS is going to be absolutely huge for this device. They need to optimize something for the bigger tablet form factor, and it would be an absolutely great OS for a tablet. And the added benefit is being able to plug in your camera if you have it with you without remembering to bring an extra adapter in order to plug that in.
I guess it really comes down to what you think the iPad. Why? Well, first of all, there's no question the iPad's successful. Friday, the 3G came out. It looks like, according to Chitika, which is a website that does some interesting IP address monitoring of iPads, that a couple of 100,000 3Gs went out the door on Friday. So they're now up to 1.3 million, according to, again, Apple's not saying, but according to Chitika, 1.3 million iPads sold in the first month. It's clearly
there
a hit.
There were lines for the 3G. I was surprised.
It's clearly a hit. Yeah. So is
yeah,
that
so
mean?
If HP sold 100,000 of their slate,
yeah,
I think they'd be very, very excited.
More iPads were sold probably in the first weekend than tablet PCs were sold in the entire 10 years of tablet PC-dom. I mean, this is, it's a category.
I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think that's actually probably very accurate.
However, I think it's very compelling to think of not just iPads, but Android-based tablets or slates, and maybe WebOS tablets or slates. And I think Google's going to do Android. Others are going to do Android. I think HP is clearly thinking along the. I mean, isn't that what we're seeing? Isn't that why they bought WebOS, Dwight? I mean, isn't that what they want to do?
If you have used the WebOS, you know that it's really it's a wonderful operating system, and I can see using those cards on a tablet. You know, moving the cards around to multitask, flicking them away. Mm-hmm. I think it would make an excellent web tablet.
Yeah. What was wrong with the Pre? The only thing wrong with the Pre was it was sluggish.
The Pre was sluggish. I actually think that the WebOS would do better on a bigger screen. And it's a good operating system for maybe the 5 to 7 inch, a 5 to 7 inch form factor. I don't think you necessarily have to get as big as the iPad. That one of the problems with Windows and all of these other desktop operating systems is that they're designed for mice and keyboards. And as Ryan said, that's just, you know, that doesn't work necessarily on a slate. It's clunky. But the WebOS, when you look at it and you've
it's a mobile OS.
Yes, very much so. I think it would do better on a tablet than it has on the Pre.
From those, I'm sure I'll see if you, three of you have seen Windows Mobile 7 phone, Windows Phone 7 Mobile. And that is Microsoft's attempt to leave behind the legacy of desktop OS crammed into a small device and make something Zune-like for a phone. Is that going to be the fourth? We've got Android, WebOS, iPad OS. Are we going to see, or iPhone OS, are we going to see, is Windows 7 Phone 7 going to be, aside from the bad name, going to be the fourth in that group?
Ryan? I've got to start thinking about tablets
Mark?
With it. I mean, they're just now building a decent phone OS, and manufacturers are now looking to Microsoft for, well, what do we put on these tablets? And all Microsoft proved with the Slate is that they don't know. The Slate Windows 7 optimized tablet OS was hideous. There are rumors that we talked about that HP just doesn't want it. We're not going to use this because it just doesn't work. That software was one of the two biggest problems with the Slate. The other was battery life. I think it was slated to have 5.5 hours of battery
life. Right, half the iPad.
You know, the one thing to remember here, and this has been, I think, a popular topic of conversation, how does Phone 7 fit into Microsoft's tablet strategy? Is there going to be a tablet-optimized version of Phone 7? And if so, how could they continue to call it Phone 7?
Right.
The thing to remember here, though, is that tablets are, I mean, this is like the second coming of tablets, right? Tablets have been around for a long time.
It's actually the fourth coming, but yeah.
Yeah, now they're kind of popular among consumers, but relatively speaking, not so much. I mean, we're talking about a potential market here of a few million units a year, which is great considering how few units tablets have sold over the last decade or so. But if you compare that to the phone space, you know, they sell their few million units, a few million phones moved every day. I mean, there are literally billions of phones sold. So,
right. I mean, Nokia puts everybody else to shame, really.
Yeah. The mobile space is kind of old news, I think, to people like us and to people who are listening to Twit. But the fact is that's where you want to be first, you know. You got to really get your skin in the game in the phone space, which is, again, I think why HP bought Palm. And once you've done that, once you kind of establish yourself as a player, then you can worry about the tablets. I'm not saying that they shouldn't worry about that, but I think they really need to worry a lot more about phones right now because that's what's selling. You know, that's what everybody's buying.
Except
tablet space is going to take a little while to heat up.
But what HP knows is the kind of form factor that the, I mean, it's closer to the tablet than it is to phones. The stuff that they've done with phones have been, frankly, awful. And I think that, you know, they can give Palm the money and the R&D support, but in their corporate boardroom and in HP's own design group, they're drooling over this. And I think they're going to see if they can get some traction in the smartphone market. But if they can't, HP has a tendency then to take the intellectual property and absorb it into other products.
It'll be on printers.
Right? Look at what they did with Voodoo. They bought this really hot game company, game PC company called Voodoo. And they started out by trying to take the Voodoo model with really hot souped up machines and HP-ize it, and it didn't really work. They tried a couple of different things, and now they've taken the technology that Voodoo had kind of championed and moved it back into their desktop and some of their notebook machines. And so I think what HP will do is they'll try to see if they can get Palm going, give it a second life, but I wouldn't give it I wouldn't give them much more than a year or a year and a half before they say to heck with it and wind up focusing on the stuff they know best, which is tablets and notebooks.
You got to think, though. I mean, I liked WebOS. I thought it was very impressive. And you got to think that the one thing Palm lacked was marketing ability, money, distribution channels. The one thing, like the eight things they lacked. They you know, those ads with the redhead were bizarre. They were on Sprint. And given a company like HP with marketing, with channels, with plenty of cash, if WebOS is going to succeed, that's the best place for it to be, yes?
Yeah, they do need to get more phones out there. They're going to do phones.
They're not known as a phone company, that's for sure.
They're not known, but Palm is. So if they could give, you know,
maybe
Palm
they keep the Palm brand.
Right. They may.
I think you're going to see them
things
keep the Palm
in the pipeline.
Brand.
It's too good a brand to kill.
Ryan, isn't there something called the C40? That is a next-gen pre called the C40 that's rumored to be coming. Do you know anything about that?
I have to say that when HP made the acquisition, they said, we're going to double down on WebOS. They didn't talk about Palm phones particularly.
They really talked about WebOS, yes.
So do you think...
Well, I mean, the phones at this point are almost secondary to the operating system. You know, I mean, phones, if you really look at, like, phone hardware, it hasn't really changed a whole lot in the past couple of years. I mean, once 3G is, like, really kind of become pervasive in the United States, there's not a whole lot left to do. I mean, you look at the last gen iPhone, or I guess the current gen iPhone, you know, the 3GS compared to the next iPhone, you're not going to see a lot of real differences. I mean, we're just talking about cameras,
right?
It's different cameras and kind of a different look and maybe a faster processor, but fundamentally it's the same thing. So hardware is actually not really the interesting thing anymore.
It's, you know, the OS.
The phone hardware has become
commoditized. It's not even the OS.
The OS that's important.
It's not even the OS. It's the apps.
Yeah, well, it's the apps. It's the apps that the OS has to have those apps,
right?
And that's, I think that's where Palm kind of squandered its biggest opportunity here, was they did not do a good enough job of getting developers to their platform, and that might have changed their fortunes before they sold HP. But
can HP do that?
I don't think it's a matter of can HP do it or can Palm. I think Palm could have done it. I think that they just didn't do it. They could have pushed harder that direction. And I think maybe they underestimated how important it was.
It's fun because really everybody's guessing, and the future is slowly becoming clear. And I don't think anybody could have predicted that the iPad was going to be what the iPad is. I don't think when Apple said we're going to do a phone, I thought, oh God, how could they possibly succeed in this space? Who knew? Apple didn't know that the apps would be all. It would be all about the apps. When Apple released the iPhone, they said, "No, you're gonna do it on the web. We don't need apps." I mean, every step of the way, it's been kind of unfolding and developing in kind of an unusual and unexpected way. Don't you think,
Leo? You don't think that Apple knew that they were going to put apps on the iPhone from day one?
You think Steve Jobs, it was disingenuous? Steve Jobs was saying, "Oh, you just develop web apps, and we don't have to." You think he knew they were going to do an app store?
Yeah, just the same way that he was talking about how terrible ebook readers are, and who wants to read ebooks?
Nobody wants to watch movies on a little screen. Nobody wants to. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look, so this is a classic Jobs. You know, he tells you all the things that you shouldn't be doing with your company, and all the technologies you shouldn't be developing at your company until he develops them. I mean, it's just, you know, it's classic bait and switch, and you know, it's he's totally diversionary, and that's fine. I mean, they, you know, they do a really good job that way, but I mean, it's really nothing new the way that he does that.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, you know, look at, they've been pretty smart, haven't they? They whatever they're doing. Steve Jobs wrote a long letter on Apple.com about why we're not going with Flash. I would like to contrast that and compare it to a really great article by a Scottish blogger named Charlie Strauss. The real reason why Steve Jobs hates Flash. We'll talk about both of these and a lot more about the tech news. This is a very interesting week. And there, as I mentioned, Apple and Siri. There's some other stuff going on, a few other things going on out there. But before we get too far down that road, let's talk about one of our great sponsors, the folks at Squarespace.com. Dane was out there in New York City visiting with them in their beautiful offices in Soho. What a great bunch of people. Anthony and the other Dane and the gang, they started Squarespace in college when they were looking for a better blogging platform. But Squarespace now is so much more than a blogging platform. If you go to Squarespace.com, you're going to see an incredible tool. It's hosting and a content management and everything you need to make a great website. Go to squarespace.com/twit. You can try it free for a couple of weeks. And by the way, you can import all your content if you're on a movable type blog or WordPress or TypePad or Blogger. Seamless blog importing means you can just, you know, go there, set up a beautiful skin, because they have some great templates, import your content and see exactly what your blog would look like on the Squarespace platform. You never run out of bandwidth, by the way. Their virtual server technology means that they can throw bandwidth at your site the minute it's needed. Great websites start at $8 a month. And if you use TWIT as the coupon code when you sign up for your website, when you decide to buy one, you'll get 10% off forever. 10% off forever. I like that. Here, Clayton's got a new site. I love Clayton's site on Squarespace. I think that picture is tongue-in-cheek. I hope so.
No, he's a good one.
Oh, I love Clayton. Gadget, sci-fi, music, sarcasm. There he is. All these great sites. This is a great way to get an idea of what Squarespace can do is in the examples section, because unlike a lot of other platforms, there's no Squarespace look. You can make it look like anything you want. It's your site. Nobody's going to say, oh, yeah, I've seen that before. No, no, no. Every site is unique. Every site is different. Every site is beautiful. And you don't have to be a designer, because the templates you start with and then the very simple configuration tools they provide you with make it so easy. You don't have to be a pro to have a site that looks like a pro designed it. You just need to go to squarespace.com. Squarespace.com/twit. Try it out for 2 weeks. And if you're a photographer, you're going to love the galleries they have here. Just gorgeous. And if you know CSS, I mean, you can do anything. There's no limit to what you can do. JavaScript and CSS, of course. Great commenting system. Great statistics. Yes, this guy's a wedding photographer. Really neat stuff. Squarespace.com/twit. Do take a look, by the way, at the iPhone application. I cannot wait till the iPad version comes out. The best blogging software. Squarespace.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. Do you think Apple buying Siri says anything about Apple's plans? Siri is a very cool program that lets you talk to your iPhone and tell it things in natural language, like book me a table for two tonight at, you know, French Laundry, or what's the score in the Giants game? And it will give you the answers. It's really kind of it's not search. It's kind of the next thing. I think Apple would love to get beyond search. They know Google owns that. Siri is a very interesting acquisition. Any thoughts on that, Mark Millian?
Yeah, Siri rocks. I actually use that quite a bit. There's two major problems with it, in that the design is not very nice. It's not Apple-y at all.
Yeah.
And one would assume that Apple buys it, Apple will take it under its wing and envelop it
or kill it like they just did with Lala.
I was going to say the exact same thing. I think that you can kiss Siri goodbye.
I guess with Lala, what they might still do a streaming kind of Lala style iTunes, or they might have just wanted the guys. Maybe they just wanted the guys. That's maybe what they wanted Siri. They just want the guys, right? Obviously, there's some smart fellas behind it or gals.
Oh, I think what
there are a lot of AccuHires happening.
They like that voice capability.
The natural language thing.
The natural language. One of the things that's very cool if you have an Android 2.1 or 2.2.
I love that.
2.2 it out yet, is the ability to talk to it into any text field.
Right.
Well, what if they put in the next iPhone the ability not just to be not just to talk text into the fields, but for it to understand what you want, which is what Siri is. So I could see them taking that technology and building it into the iPhone OS and go and Google what better.
That's what I was thinking. That search screen on the iPhone, which isn't very good, I could see that being just the Siri app built in. You slide over one home screen, and you get this fully featured search app that can pull from the internet and pull from the contents on your phone, and you can use voice to search through it, and it's like a digital assistant. I feel like Siri, the concept, is good enough to be something that's built directly into the phone and could replace their search function.
It does seem to me that it's a direct response to Android 2.1. Has anybody tried the Incredible? I played with one yesterday. Of course you have one, I'm sure, Ryan. You like it?
I do.
What kind of battery life are you getting?
On camera. Yeah, no, it's a great phone.
How about the battery life, though, guys?
I mean, it's pretty good. It suffers from the same Android problems that every Android OS has suffered from in terms of battery life. It's just you run things in the background and it starts to suck up a lot of power, especially the Twitter apps. I'll sometimes forget and I'll have Peep going, which is the one that comes with this particular HTC model made by HTC, and the new Twitter app I'll have running as well and just forget, and it'll be sucking down background power both at the same time.
That Twitter app sucks, by the way. Twitter's own app. It's not the best Android app. SeezMix's better. Twitter made it. Well, it spends all this energy having clouds float around. I don't want clouds. I want functionality. You like it? Is that what you use? You use Peep? You use that? Or what do you... Mark?
I've been using Peep for the most part, but it's decent. I mean, there's really not a whole lot that main Twitter app developers can do anymore.
I guess you're right. I guess you're right. It's Twitter's world. We just live in it. let Twitter be Twitter.
Right. I mean, they're really pushing sort of these for app developers to go into these alternative spaces.
Right.
Like they opened up that annotation feature because they want to see. I was talking to Jack Dorsey in New York a couple of weeks ago, and he was like, sometimes developers need a push. Sometimes we need to say, we're going to create this base app for the phones, and we're going to have it for every platform, so you guys don't need to worry about that. Here are all these other cool things to
play
with.
Don't worry about your revenue, your model, the application you spent 6 months writing. Don't worry about that. We got it.
Well, I mean,
think they were just kind of
let's
bored
be totally
with all
honest
these
and fair.
Copycats.
And, you know, I say this with all respect to my friends, you know, like Loic, who, you know, he's done
Seismic.
A great job with Seismic. But if you have built an entire business around somebody else's platform, you can't, you're not allowed. I'm telling you, I am demanding that you not be surprised or shocked when something happens and the platform changes and your business model is messed up.
You say there's no whining for parasites, not allowed.
It's not that it's not allowed. It's just if you're going to put the entire, you know, well-being of your business on one single thing that Twitter could change in a heartbeat, or that Facebook could change in a heartbeat.
Tell that to Mark Pincus.
Then
of
you haven't
Zynga.
Done a very good job with your business.
Tell that to Mr. Farmville.
I wonder what they're thinking over there right now, because I mean they're making an ungodly amount of money,
like $500 million a year.
Yeah, but that could change very quickly. I mean, what if Facebook tomorrow says, okay, we've had enough of these shady tactics that are going on with some of the games in our platform. So we're going to say no more games, and we're going to have an online game house. We're going to own it. We're going to operate it. And we're going to make our own Farmville. And sorry, Zynga.
Right.
They'd be within their right to do that.
This is the world we live in, by the way. If you're an Apple developer, you live and die by what Steve Jobs says. And if heaven forfend, you're an Apple gaming platform like OpenFaint or Plus, and Apple says, we're going to do a gaming system, it's like, okay. Or if you're a ad mob type, you know, mobile ad platform, and Apple says, we're going to do iAds. I mean, this seems to be happening more and more, doesn't it? It used to be, in my day, Microsoft would do anything to appease developers because you don't have a platform unless you have people developing for it. Now it really looks like these companies couldn't care less. The developers are like, we got you. You go wherever we say you go.
I don't know about that. It's been happening for a while. Like, you look at when Microsoft integrated Internet Explorer into Windows, and it's this free browser, so why are you going to pay for Netscape? And that completely changed.
Killed Netscape. You know, you're right.
And something like Apple did it, like 4 or 5 years ago when Confabulator was this awesome widgets platform that Yahoo ends up buying, turns into Yahoo Widgets, and then...
Dashboard.
A year later, we get Dashboard built into OS.
I guess you're right. Maybe it's nothing new. You're an old fart like me, Dwight. Does this seem like it's something new? Or
No, I was thinking about AOL, that when AOL had businesses that built up around it plugged into its... plugged into its client, and then suddenly they said, and there was some revenue derived from that, from businesses who contributed to the client. And then when AOL said, we're going to go free, and the client will be free, and everybody can connect, all of a sudden, a lot of these businesses, their value was much less. And now what is AOL? It's a collection of websites.
AOL
so
just...
I think it happens a lot.
AOL just sold ICQ... to a Russian developer for $187 million. I think that's actually a good deal. I think I'd take the money and run, although investors were hoping for more. Digital Sky Technologies, which, by the way, to tie this all together, has a big stake in Facebook and Zynga.
Skynet. It's Skynet.
Digital Skynet Technologies. shares of AOL dropped $4 on this news. Well, maybe that's it wasn't this news. It was the fact that their profit fell by 59%. That was
investors
that.
Investors were like, not ICQ.
No, ICQ, we love you.
How much did they pay for ICQ originally? Did they?
Oh, that's a good question.
In terms of like
dollars. $400 or $500 million. They lost a lot of money on it.
They did. Oh,
but not surprising. I mean, it was one of those, you know, Web 1.0 properties. You know, clearly is not going to go for what they bought it at in the 90s.
Example of how things change. And, you know, at the time, AOL had AIM, and it seemed like a sensible thing to consolidate and own the instant messenger market, and things went differently, you know.
For what it's worth, when you're talking about the instant messenger market, AOL still does pretty much own it. If you're talking about the kind of web-based IM market, like GChat and Facebook chat, I mean, those are different. I would put those in a different space.
That's only in the U.S., though. I mean, you look at worldwide stats, and AIM is, I don't even think it's in the top five. It's all about Windows Skype. Messenger and Skype. And Skype is number one. And even Yahoo Messenger worldwide has a bigger market share than AIM.
It was a real revelation to me when I went to Canada, and the dominant, I mean, totally dominant messengers is MSN Messenger.
It is in a lot of countries, yeah.
Yeah, they don't, AIM, it's like, what you're on what? They don't know. Maybe because it's America Online, I don't know. But MSN is huge in Canada, and I think in a lot of countries. And I never used MSN Messenger, so I am just. I think IM is a cautionary tale to Twitter and other of these systems that if you let it fragment into too many, you know, you have too many dial tones, and people can't talk to one another. Even it's just not gonna. Nobody's gonna succeed. You need one, you know, platform, one standard, preferably, in my opinion, open. Which brings us to Steve Jobs' letter about why we're not using Flash. So I'm just curious. I'm not going to say what I think. What do you think of this letter? Let's go in the upper left corner to block. Mr. Dwight Silverman.
Well, I'm glad Steve Jobs finally wrote in his blog again.
it's been a long time since he blogged.
None of it was new. You know, the stuff that he wrote, he has said before. I found it interesting that he chose to write about that now with all of the other criticism that's been leveled at Apple that kind of he out of the blue popped up and wrote about Flash. But
well, it's kind of timely because CS5 just came out and he had clobbered the cross-platform development and then the iPad's out. And a lot of people saying, oh, well, okay, not going to have iPad Flash.
I guess it's a, you know, I guess it's an explainer to developers and the rest of us kind of just get to sit and critique it. But I'm, you know, frankly, there was not much new there, and the tone and the attitude was almost condescending. And I keep thinking about those things that I've been reading on how he has a grudge against Adobe because yeah. of how Adobe kind of walked away from Apple when it was in on its in its death throes and embraced Windows.
What do you think, Ryan?
When you say condescending, condescending to who?
I think he was trying to sound statesmanlike, but it came off condescending to Adobe, condescending to those folks who support cross-platform development. I think he was kind of just saying...
Let me read it my best Alex Trebek yeah. voice. Oh, I'm sorry. Flash was created during the PC era for PCs and mice. Flash is a successful business for Adobe. We can understand why they'd want to push it beyond PCs. But the mobile era, it's all about low-power devices, touch interfaces, and open web standards, all areas where Flash falls short.
Yeah, that's a condescending. Nice job, Leo.
Yeah, you gotta do the Alex Trebek to really get the condescension in there. I think
I'm gonna be squarely not on the side of Steve in particular, but in my opinion, anyone doing what they can to diminish the importance and reliance on Flash is doing God's work.
I think in the long run, if everybody moves off of Flash and it looks like, you know, iPhone and iPad and iPod Touch is so important that a lot of sites are, that's a good thing in general.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, Adobe argues that Flash is an open standard. I think that there are a lot of people who would argue against that. Either way, even if it is an open standard, it's a standard controlled by one company, and it's no longer necessary. I mean, we're getting to the point now where the burgeoning HTML5 standards, CSS, JavaScript, and H.264 completely negate the need for Flash. And there are the very real problems that Steve presented, and these are not new problems. These have always been problems with Flash. If you've ever looked at what happens to your computer's resources when you're running a lot of Flash, you know the idea that Flash does not consume a lot of your CPU, that it doesn't run down your battery faster, that it is every bit as high performing as native web technologies. I mean, it's just completely false. There's you can't really argue with these facts. So the one thing that you can do is kind of say, well, you know, here are the things that Flash is good for. Here are the things that Flash is needed for right now. And there are a few things, but the number of those things that Flash is needed for is decreasing almost by the day. And that is part of the reason why Jobs' letter is so timely. There's not a lot to argue with in that letter.
Well, I mean,
it's very accurate overall.
But he kind of neglected the fact that it's also really good business for Apple to screw Adobe, right?
Well, in what regard?
Well, I think you could talk about the fact that Apple doesn't want cross-platform development on its iPhone and iPad, because then somebody might develop an application for other people besides just Apple. They want to kind of completely hog the space.
No, I don't think that's good for users.
Steve says it's good for users, but is it?
I mean, I think that no company has ever been able to fulfill on the promise of write once, run anywhere in a way that is actually as high quality as an app that's been written native for a platform. And when we're talking about the mobile space, it's not enough for it to just run. It has to run and do things that are optimized to the experience. And so, you know, when I'm thinking about the mobile apps that we might do for our site, it had never even occurred to me. It occurred to me, but it was never a possibility in my mind that we would do a cross-platform kind of, one of those crappy apps like PhoneGap or whatever, because you need to write native to the platform that you're running it in. And if you're going to be able to take advantage of the technologies of the platform, you just have to do that. So for Apple to be beholden to anybody else's technology when they're building, when they're trying to build an app ecosystem on their own platform is crazy. And you know, I think that anybody else should be taking that stance too. I think Microsoft, Palm, Android, they should all be looking at this in the exact same way, which is, you know, you need to be writing apps that are meant for this platform.
You agree, Mark? What what was your take on this Jobs letter?
I don't totally buy the that there's this fear from Apple that everybody's going to start making games for Flash and not for the iPhone. Games for Flash just really aren't that good in general. And for the most part, Ryan's right. HTML5 is really catching up to Flash and what it can do. There are HTML5 games that I've played on my iPhone. I think the site is called Akihabara, and there's this little
Oh, yeah, that's Mario a great site, game. Yeah.
Yeah, and it works on the iPhone, it works on the iPad. I agree with the underlying principles of moving beyond Flash because, really, Flash sucks, but it's still everywhere. And maybe this push from Apple, this is a push that that the internet needs in order to get rid of this proprietary standard. But I still am annoyed when I go to like Gawker TV or NewYorkTimes.com and hit a video that's in Flash and I just can't view it. What am I going to say? Oh, well, it's not important because it's made in Flash. I'm just not going to watch it.
Akihabara is a HTML5 library that allows you very easily, I guess, to create 8 and 16-bit era games in JavaScript that run in HTML5 browsers. It's KESIEV.com/Akihabara. It's certainly a good demo. Have you been following the code? See, one of the things that HTML5 is going to have to resolve is what video codec to use. And this is suddenly emerging as a huge fight because H.264, which kind of has the inside track on all of this, is not open. It's owned by MPEG LA, which charges $5 million as its license fee. So Mozilla, among others, there's the HTML5 conferences coming up, is saying we're not going to support H.264. We don't want to pay the license fee. Plus, we believe it should not be a patented technology. They're going to support Ogg Theora or maybe a Google's VP8, which they got when they bought On2. And there's a real kind of battle going on around H.264. I'll point you to some articles. BNet has an article. In the mobile video standards fight, consumers are poised to lose. If H.264 wins, I didn't know this. If you buy a camcorder that supports AVC HD, which is an H.264 standard, you probably know about this, Ryan. There is, in the license fee, says you may not use this camcorder for commercial work.
Yeah, it's tricky. And the thing with Ogg, and this is part of the reason why Google bought Onto in order to get VP8. Part of the thing with Ogg is, although it was developed to be open source, there's still a lot of debate that that it's still using, or I should say, kind of overlapping some of the intellectual property that is created by the MPEG LA, which owns H.264 and some of these other things. It's never intentional. But it's like, you know, there are only so many ways to skin a cat, so right. to speak. And you know, there are some times where you may not know that you're infringing on other people's intellectual property, and you are. So, you know, some companies have actually shied away from Ogg because they think that they might get submarined in a patent case.
Much as HTC, and we'll talk about this, and Microsoft, the Linux issue. Because Microsoft,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, Microsoft says, we're going to support H.264 only.
Right.
Opera and Firefox says we're not going to support H.264, so HTML5 is not in the clear by any means.
Well, this doesn't relate to HTML5 directly. HTML5 will continue to move ahead with or without these codecs.
But you've got to settle on a standard.
Yeah, but that standard has nothing to do with HTML5. HTML5 is a standard for markup on the web and for displaying this content. The codec is at the browser level, and that has to be worked out, but it's not going to delay the rollout of HTML5 itself. It will just delay how long it takes for us to move away from Flash-based video players.
Right. Steve Jobs sent an email out on April 30th. You know, I love how Steve is talking to people now through email. This is his new method. Hugo Roy sent him an email questioning this choice over H.264 over Ogg and so forth. And Jobs said exactly what you said, Ryan. in his response, all sent from my iPad, by the way, all video codecs are covered by patents. A patent pool is being assembled to go after Theora and other, quote, open source codecs now. Unfortunately, just because something is open source doesn't mean or guarantee that it doesn't infringe on others' patents. An open standard is different from being royalty-free or open source. Boy, that's a long response for Steve. He usually doesn't type so much on his...
He usually just says, nope.
Yep, nope.
It's a complicated issue, though. You know, I mean, we like to think that just because something is open source doesn't, you know, means that it's not going to be affected by these technologies. The thing is, like I said, sometimes you don't know. You don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And so as you're building out Ogg, you might be infringing on some obscure MPEG LA IP. And then, you know, you've gotten away with it so far because it hasn't really been widely used. Right. But at some point, MPEG LA or other players might decide that they want to go after you.
So maybe VP8 is the way to go, because at least you know Google wants to keep it open, right?
Well, they want to, but they haven't made a completely open license yet. And I think people are assuming that that's what's going to happen, but we don't know.
That could solve the problem.
Part of what we've been kind of waiting for is to know what the MPEG LA is actually going to do with H.264. So they've kept it on like a pseudo open license where it doesn't cost anything to implement. Right. I think until like 2012 or something like that.
Come and on in. The water's fine. Come on. Use that code.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to love H.264. It's perfect.
Come to adopt it. And then they hit you. Or not. We don't know.
We don't know, but why take the chance?
Yeah, it's tricky. But I mean, you know, this is a problem with Flash too, because Flash is continually using H.264 as the video codec behind the player. YouTube has moved to H.264 as the video codec behind all of their videos. And it's still playing in a Flash player, but if you swap out the player for an HTML5 player, you still have the IP issues of which codec you're using.
So I mentioned Charlie Strauss in his blog, Charlie's Diary. We tried to get Charlie on the show, and he never heard a twit, so he says, I'm busy. But he's in Scotland. Why should he bother? But he wrote, I thought this was very interesting, on antipope.org, his blog. I've got a theory, and it's this. Steve Jobs believes he's gambling Apple's future on an all-or-nothing push into a new market. HP have woken up and smelled the forest fire 2 or 3 years late. Microsoft are mired in a tar pit, unable to grasp that the inferno heading towards them is going to burn down the entire ecosystem in which they exist. There is a smell of panic in the air, and here's why. He says, we've known since the 90s that the internet was the future of computing. With increased bandwidth, data doesn't need to be trapped in the hard drives of our desktop computers. Data and interaction could follow us out into the world we live. He says, mobile is where it's happening. And the PC industry is dying because margins in the PC industry are so razor thin. He says PCs are becoming commodity items with margins of typical netbooks or desktop PCs under 10%. Apple survived because they make a premium product, but he believes in the long run it's not going to be the PC that survives. It's the iPhone OS, the iPad isn't just the start of a whole new range of Apple computers. He says it's a hugely ambitious attempt to keep Apple relevant to the future of computing once Moore's Law tapers off and the personal computer industry craters and turns into a profitability wasteland. Steve has realized that ownership of the channel is everything. The iTunes store, the App Store. He says even if he's reduced to giving away the machines, as long as he can charge rent for access to data or apps, he's got a business model. Does that make sense? He calls it the I can't pronounce it. The Mac apocalypse. In fact, the Apple Design Awards at the WWDC will only be open, and this was kind of interesting tea leaves, only open to iPhone and iPad apps. No OS X apps will be offered a design award. Shocked silence from the panel. I think
I mean, this is not new.
It's not new.
If you look at WebOS, if you look at Phone 7, even to a certain extent Android, I mean, everybody wants to kind of own their ecosystem.
But are we in a post-PC era? I mean, is that why?
No, I think it's way too early to make any claims like that.
You know, you're Cyloning, Dwight, if you would do something.
Oh, no.
Something magical. I don't know what. It's been exactly 1 hour. It's something about this chipset after 1 hour. it starts doing this weird thing, and all you have to do is unplug and plug it in again, and then suddenly the driver reloads or something. There's a, it's like a memory leak in the thing. That's a nice chair, by the way, Dwight. There he is. All better.
Okay. No,
yes.
So I think this is, I agree with Ryan. I don't believe that this is new, and people have been predicting the end of the PC.
I know. I remember asking, it was at Comdex, that's how long ago it was, asking the chairman of Intel, is the PC dead? He said, what are you talking about? You nuts.
And of course, Apple sees things from its own perspective. I think that open is good, and open wins a lot of times. Whether it wins in the mobile space and in the when you're connecting to telecom broadband networks, whether it wins, I don't know yet. We'll see what happens with Android. But I think that Apple is planning on that, and that big mysterious data center out in North Carolina, I think, is for iTunes.com and a lot of other services.
The next Lala. That's where Lala will be.
Right. But I think Apple will always build. I mean, they have a lot of infrastructure and a lot of design investment in MacBooks, MacBook Pros, maybe less so now in the iMac and the desktops. But I think that you will see PCs go on for a long, long time. I mean, look, you know, the refrigerator market is everybody has a refrigerator, but, you know, there's definitely a refrigerator industry.
No, but so that's saying it's saturated. I don't think it's that it's saturated. I think that it no longer serves us. That with lightweight, portable devices, ubiquitous high-speed mobile internet, who needs a PC?
Well, I think it depends on the work you're doing. You know, if you are editing high-definition video, you don't want to do that an iPad.
Well, some people do that, but that's a small minority of people.
I think you want the appropriate tool for the job.
Well, you have to have a PC to write iPad apps. People are going to have PCs. I'm not saying they're gone.
Right.
I think normal people, though, may be much less interested in PCs in 5 years. That's the point here. And if you are HP, see, don't you think for all the stroking HP did to Microsoft, that really HP is looking past to a post-Windows time?
I think every company that deals with Microsoft and has dealt with Microsoft for a long time would like there to be a post-Microsoft time.
Maybe that's it. I know Intel did. I know Craig Barrett. It was Andy Grove. That's how long ago it was. I remember I was talking to him, and he was off camera and off the record. He said, I hate Microsoft. I hate them. Kill them. All right. And I think it's an interesting conversation. Maybe it's premature to ask this, but I wouldn't be surprised if in 5 or 10 years – we'll look back and we say, oh, yeah, that was kind of the PC kind of started to go away. It's a commodity market. It's a razor thin margins. And frankly, consumers want something easier, simpler, portable. No?
This is a watershed month, I think.
That's what I think.
Certainly 10 years from now, you can go back and if MP3 files are still supported on the web, you can go back and listen to this, but I'll do a prediction that the release of the iPad, the acquisition of Palm, kind of the posturing over Flash, and the kind of everything that you've been seeing right now, right down to Jason Chen's computers being confiscated, because it's all part of the same story, right? Is going to be considered, this is going to be a watershed time in tech.
Agreed, Ryan Block?
I think so, but I think people are, I mean, you already touched on this, Leo. I think people are very quick and almost sometimes a little bit gleeful to predict the death of the PC. I don't see it going anywhere.
No, it's not the death.
I see there as being a very possibly being a new third device that people care about, and that's the tablet.
Right.
But even that is yet to be seen.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
it's early days.
I would say with iPad, having used it and seen how it fits into my life personally, that I think other people will find that this is a really great computing experience. But it is not yet proven. Right? If you really look at things, like, you know, we all kind of take it for granted, but not everybody who owns a PC has one of these yet, obviously. And it's going to be years before we know if this is actually just kind of a flash in the pan.
And meanwhile, Lucid Lynx comes out, Ubuntu 10.04. They march on. They soldier on. How about you, Mark Millian? You're a young person. People of your age. What do they think?
I'm just glad we get to see a lot of the bickering between the big companies happening out in the open. I mean, for the most part with HP, they're like, oh, we love you, Microsoft, but we bought this company and they're a direct competitor in many spaces. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm glad that the Apple Adobe thing has finally come out in the open. Like, among people who watch that space closely, it was like, yeah, it's obvious. They hate each other. There's a dispute there. And now, like, Steve Jobs is writing opuses about how much he hates Flash, and Adobe's coming out and blasting and saying, we're the open platform, and Apple's saying, we're the open platform. Neither of them are open.
It's not a new era. It's not a post-PC era. It's a new era of CEO bickering.
I love it.
Yeah, more fun for us.
It is really entertaining.
It is very entertaining. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, some interesting acquisition news and more. Google just acquired BumpTop. I don't know. Maybe the desktop isn't dead. It's just going to be 3D. Before we do that, I want to mention Audible.com, the great bookstore. 75,000 titles. I just got the new count in the Audible store. If you love listening, and I know you do, you wouldn't be listening to Twit, you're going to love Audible. Audible's all about audiobooks. So if you've, you know, found it difficult to find time to read, and who doesn't in this busy world, this is your savior. Listen in the car, in the commute. Listen when you're in the gym. Listen when you're on your bike or taking a walk, walking the dog. By doing this, you suddenly find time, and I've listened to at least two books a month. Somebody said, you can't call it reading, Leo, because the brain apprehends the information in a different form. Well, every word in the book's there. I don't know if it's reading or not, but boy, you sure get the words in there. And there's so many great things from the nonfiction history. I'm listening right now to the history of the campaign, the 2008 presidential campaign, just fascinating. Two great fiction stories. I'm listening to Time Traveler's Wife. I like to listen to books that were movies before I see the movie. To, you know, stories of things like the Beatles and Oral History, Volume 1, The Formation of the Band. I mean, audio brings things to life. Movies in your mind. Now, you can go to audible.com/twit2 and get two books free. You'll sign up for the Platinum account. That's what I have. Two books a month. And your first two are free. You can cancel at any time, so there doesn't have to be any cost or obligation to you. But it's a good way to get an idea of what Audible is like. Pick two exciting, interesting, entertaining books. And get enthralled, get involved. Audible.com/twit2. A whole world of listening awaits you at Audible. Plays on all the devices. They're working on the Android, but right now, of course, on the iPhone, the iPad, the Zune, the Kindle, many GPS devices, the Sansas. Audible.com/twit2. I can't recommend it more highly. It's just wonderful. By the way, we do this podcast with Rod Savage, who's rowing across the Pacific right now. She's a featured listener at audible.com, and she's actually put together a list of her favorite books as she rows. She listens. She rows like 16 hours a day, so she goes through a book a day. A book a day. I gave her, many of these books are books I gave her, thousands of books she's gone through. And so this is Roz's list. It's all at audible.com. Pick two of these and call me in the morning. All right, we're talking Twit right now. Mark Millian is here from the Los Angeles Times, latimes.com. Mark, do you have a personal blog or somewhere you want to point people to?
Yeah, you could get my Twitter and Google Buzz stuff at heyniceblog.com.
Hey, that's a good name. It's a little generic.
Hey, it is.
Hey, nice blog. You know, Dane, our executive producer here at Twit, has hey.com. You guys should get
excellent domain.
Isn't that a good name?
Yeah.
Wow. We got a forbidden.
It's down. It's down right now. He's working on it. But hey, nice blog is up. The iPad Cafe. I love it. And of course, the LA Times.
What about switching from Posters to Tumblr? Haven't decided.
Oh, no. Stay. I like Posters. But you know, Posters doesn't have any design style, right? But what you do with Posters, I wouldn't use it as a blog. I would use it as a platform so that it gets your stuff to your blog. So you can create a Tumblr. On Tumblr, the Posters feeds to. Best of both worlds, right?
I should probably set that up.
Yeah, because I use Posters, like when I was traveling, not that we're doing an ad for it, but when I was traveling In China, I would just post stuff via email to Posterous, and then it would go out to my other blogs. Tumblr's pretty good, too. They're both good. Also with us, Ryan Block, GDGT. That's the place to go. Ryan's a great website. He does this with Peter Rojas. And now you've got news there as well as you know, a list of your favorite gadgets. How's the iPad going? What is the hot I have gadget right now on GDGT?
iPad is not the hot I have gadget.
It's a hot I want.
Not as many people have bought it yet, but I think it's the most wanted gadget. At least one of the most wanted gadgets. Actually, I think the most owned gadget is either the 3G or the 3GS. I think we have like 20,000 people who have one on the site.
So you go to gdgt.com and you you enter in all the stuff you have, and that's a great way to find out about it and get news and stuff. And you can put in the stuff you want, which is kind of cool, and have conversations with people about it. And, you know, every time I go back here, of course, more gadgets in here. It's really become the definitive encyclopedia of gadgetry.
We've got a lot of products in the site now.
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, great place to learn about stuff. This is my stream. Also here, Mr. Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle, blogs.cron.com/techblog. And that link roll that you do, the link posts that you do every day, are really a great way to keep up on what's going on in tech news. I read it religiously.
Well, thank you. I have a great time doing it. And Ryan, I want to say I thought Gadget was one of the best ideas for a website in a long time. I love it.
Yeah,
you could. Thanks. I appreciate you saying that.
Isn't it clever?
It's brilliant. It really is.
Yeah. So we got some good people.
I appreciate that.
It's a little self-congratulatory in here right now, but that's okay. That's all right. I could take it. We're almost done here. What are some of the other hot stories? Have we missed anything you guys want to talk about?
I actually talked to Ryan last week for a story I was working on.
Oh, that's right.
The unveiling of Boy Genius behind the Boy Genius Report, who just recently sold his blog, his mobile rumors and news blog, in a multi-million dollar deal.
One blog, TBG, for more than $1 million. That's amazing.
And you know what really bums me out is, I named it and I didn't see a penny.
you knew this guy. Did you know he was the Boy Genius?
Well, yeah. I mean, he used to write for me.
Of course you knew. Of course you knew
and,
it.
The Boy Genius Report, the name of his site, is the name that I came up with for his column. And when he told me that he wanted to do his own site, you know, I kind of gave him my blessing to take the name and run with it. And man, I should have gotten in writing or something. I could have really used
it's a great
couple
name.
Bucks on the thing.
It's a great name
and
for a blog.
His real name actually appeared on Engadget in association with that in a couple of posts, right? He was actually
We should
not,
have known. It was obvious who
he
was.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of an open secret. My favorite thing was, for years, people would come up to me and ask me if I was Boy Genius. And it never really made any sense to me because, I mean, why would I need to write under a pseudonym? I was breaking all kinds of stories myself. John has done a really good job, I think, at, even though it was kind of an open secret among people who knew him, at keeping it from getting out.
He looks like Lee Harvey Oswald in the picture on the Times, but
I thought he looked like Seth MacFarlane.
Oh, he does a little bit. The creator of Family Guy. He does look like Seth MacFarlane. He's 23. So he was a teenager when he started working for you.
As many
he was 16 when he went to Engadget.
Unbelievable. Good for you, Jonathan Geller, now a millionaire. And they're going to rename the Boy Genius Report to TBG.com, right?
BGR.
BGR. Oh, BGR. What am I saying? TBG. That's something else. I just made that up. TBG.
This doesn't happen very often anymore. You know, it used to happen fairly frequently, but the last one I can remember that's like this was JK on the Run, James Kendrick's blog getting acquired by GigaOM.
Right.
But this is kind of relatively rare now.
Ooh, they got a little bit of a scoop on BGR.com right now. Adobe to distribute Android handsets to its employees. This is more of that CEO infighting. Okay. In that case, we're going to give the Nexus 1 to our employees. Wow. It's great, great blog. Congratulations, Jonathan, on a job well done. And send Ryan a buck or two.
Yeah, I could use a couple bucks.
He deserves a little.
I'm living the startup life now.
He deserves a little money.
I don't have that Leo Laporte money.
Oh yeah, that money. Where is that money? Is that under my desk? Where is that money? I need that money. Did you see our good friends Nitrozak and Snaggy, who do all of our album art? They do the Joy of Tech comic at geekculture.com. They did a really fun Steve Jobs email generator. We were talking about the nope and yep. First, you create the letter to Steve Jobs. Hi, Steve. I'm a longtime Apple fan, a longtime Apple enemy, new to Apple, new to hating Apple. You know, there's quite a few choices. And so you put it all together. You know, who loves everything you do, can't stop eating potato chips, has a lot of time to kill, would like to offer advice, can see you now on my magic iPad. You are insanely great, my hero, arrogant, pompous, pretentious, rotten, my benevolent dictator, the wind beneath my wings. I have a question about my iPhone, iPad, iPod, MacBook, Newton, one-button mouse, no-button mouse, my dad's cousin's dentist's iPod shuffle. Anyway, once you write the email, here's Steve's reply. You get some choices. No, nope, no big deal, nope, no, sorry, no, no way, no chance in hell, no way, expletive, 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 not to worry, not a yep, okay. Or, if you want porn, get an Android phone. Which Steve actually said.
Yeah, to me, to my question.
It was your question. Was he giving you personal advice, or was it just a kind of in general?
No, the question I asked was, I think a lot of people would like to see Apple open up the platform. I mean, obviously, it's a very contentious issue for Apple, the closed nature of the App Store. So why not just bury a setting, you know, five levels right. deep in the settings, like Android does, that right. allows you to run unsigned apps. And his response to that was, well, yeah, we could do that, but Android has a porn store. So, you know, if you want to look at porn on your phone, go get Android.
That's a way to turn it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, and by that point, you know, the mic had already gone back to the PR person and it was on to the next question.
No follow-ups.
They would like to have asked about Safari and maybe we should lock that down. So you can't view any porn.
No follow-ups.
What'll be interesting is when Steve Jobs appears on the stage at D8 with Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg. And, you know, obviously a lot of these things will still be unresolved by the time he gets on stage. I think that's in June.
Yeah, and you know that Kara and Malt will ask tough questions.
Maybe. But also, if it's in June and if we have an announcement on the next iPhone, there may be, you know, mostly a lot of drooling over the hardware, and there may not be a whole lot of hard balls thrown. I hope they throw some hard balls.
Should be interesting. And we tried to get Kara on today. She was unavailable. We'll get her on either before or after that event, or maybe both, and get her take. Maybe we can feed her some questions to ask Steve. One last story before we go, just a little word of warning. May 5th, the internet might fail. Just thought you'd like to know. Keep your eye peeled and perhaps save up some sites in your browser just so you don't have to go porn-free on May 5th. ICANN will complete the first phase of the rollout of DNSSEC, which is the security extensions for the broken DNS system. This is actually very important. They've been delaying it because there is some risk that it would cause your browser to fail. According to some security experts, older networking equipment might see these larger requests as a problem, block them under the assumption they represent an anomaly and take you off the internet. So just a word of warning, May 5th, if the internet goes down, it's going to be okay. It'll come back one of these days. The big ones will be all right. Ryan Block is at gdgtgadget.com. Thank you for being here, Ryan. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Leo.
Always a pleasure to have you. Mr. Mark Millian. Oh, what? Something to plug?
Oh, I'm sorry. Before we go, though, Chicago people, I'd really like to invite you to our event. We're coming to Chicago May 12th.
Where and when? And how can I find out more?
It's on the site. It's on gddgt.com. It's on features.gddgt.com.
Are you doing a party?
We're doing an event. So the kind of event that we did out in San Francisco, we did one at South by Southwest.
That was fun.
At Chicago.
Yeah.
sorry, I'm just really excited about it. I wanted to make sure people knew because, you know, Chicago doesn't see a lot of these kinds of gadgety events come through.
Gallery 233, that's 233 West Huron, 7 p.m. A good place to see lots of gadgets. I'm sure there'll be an Incredible there. Maybe other some other new stuff. Who knows, you know?
Yeah, you will definitely see the Incredible there and Windows Phone 7 and a lot of other cool stuff.
Yeah, the Kin is coming out the day before.
I didn't mean to cut you off, Dwight.
The Kin is coming out May 6th that Microsoft's announced, so you'll have some Kins there, I'm sure, too. Very fun. GDGT Live in Chicago, May 12th. Mark Million, when's your party?
I'm not throwing a party, but if anyone in LA wants to get a beer, send me an email. But I can vouch for Ryan's parties. I went to one at CES, and it was awesome.
Awesome.
Oh, the one that we did this year with Lenovo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We met there, actually, I think.
Yeah, that was a little bit unusual for us because I've never really done a party at CES before. That was pretty fun.
Yeah, that was cool.
We're trying to do... I'm waiting to hear from Ford. There's a Maker Faire coming to Detroit in July. And just like you, I think we should do more stuff kind of in the middle of the country instead of the left or the right coasts. So we want to do an event in Detroit in July. So stay tuned for that. If we can, we're going to tie it in with Maker Faire out there. Mr. Continental Airlines merges with United Airlines. So now Dwight Silverman lives in the biggest hub of all. I'm just, you know, okay, great. So Houston's the place to live, right?
Houston's a place to live, and Ryan, you need to do one of these parties here in Houston.
Yeah.
Come in August when it's really nice and cool.
I don't know about Houston. We did one in Austin though for South by.
That was fun.
That one was a lot of fun.
No, but see, you go to Houston, you get the wonderful oil washing up on the shore. You get this.
No, that's in Louisiana.
But aren't you on the Gulf? I mean, couldn't it come your way too?
The way the placement of the well and the way the current is flowing. For now, is keeping it away from us. They've closed fishing from Louisiana east, but so far we've been okay here.
Oh, thank goodness. That's a mess.
But seriously, Ryan, consider it. I know, you know, Leo won't come to Houston, but I know you will.
It's too hot.
maybe too next hot. Year. I think we've got our venues scoped out for this year. But 2011, I'm gonna make sure that our guy who's doing our events knows about Houston.
2011. Aren't there some big tech companies in Houston that might sponsor Ryan's visit?
No.
It's NASA. Isn't the Space Center there, NASA?
Yeah, sure. NASA will sponsor you, Ryan. Bring it.
They got money to burn.
I'll get right on that. NASA, you know, those guys have endless amounts of cash.
That's right. Now that they're not flying space shuttles anymore.
We have friends in Houston because of the Space Center down there. I think maybe we should go down there. Would you accept TWIT?
Bring it.
Bring it, he says. Bring it. blogs.cron.com/techblog. Thank you very much all for being here. Don't forget, you can watch us do this show every Sunday afternoon, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. If you are outside of the U.S., that's, I think, 2200 UTC. And, of course, you'll then see it on YouTube, on the Twit channel there, youtube.com/twit, or on iTunes or anywhere that better podcasts are carried. We thank you for being here, and we'll see you next week. Another Twit is in the can.
Doing the Twit.